This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson in Washington. If you watch TV, you have almost certainly heard certain phrases in commercials. Phrases like powerful protection or terms like antibiotic.
Introducing Band-Aid brand antibiotic bandages with doctor-recommended antibiotic right on the pad for powerful protection.
Antibacterial.
New Palmolive antibacterial is like nothing else.
And it doesn't just kill some of the germs.
New Lifebuoy with Active 5 kills 99.9% of harmful germs in just 10 seconds.
Or maybe it helps fight germs off.
Now, every box of Kellogg's Rice Krispies cereal has antioxidants and nutrients that help support your child's immune system.
Now, nothing against those products, but researchers are learning more about what our aggressively antibacterial lifestyles are doing to us. Among other things, they might be making us sicker. But before you pour out your Purell or say bye-bye to Band-Aids, it's worth getting the latest info about our immune system. How well do we really understand it, or understand the bacteria and viruses it encounters? Before we dive in, please bear in mind that none of what we'll discuss today is a substitute for professional medical advice. So, if this information seems like it might apply to you, please consult your doctor. With that said, joining us from San Francisco is Matt Richtel, a Pulitzer Prize-winning writer for The New York Times. He spent the last decade studying the immune system. His new book is called An Elegant Defense, The Extraordinary New Science of the Immune System. Matt, welcome to 1A.
Well, thank you for having me, Joshua.
We also welcome your questions and stories about the immune system. Email us, 1A@WAMU.org, comment on our Facebook page, or tweet us at 1A. Matt Richtel, how did this book come about? Why did you decide to write it?
Well, this book came about through really an extraordinary personal experience about a guy I knew from high school named Jason. People are saying, well, now what could that have to do with my immune system? My short answer is everything. Can I tell you a little bit about this guy?
Sure.
So in high school, eons ago, I won't say how long, Jason was one of a group of seven of us, and he was Mr. Everything, all-state baseball, all-state basketball. Man, he was such a good-looking guy. All the girls loved him. He had one blemish, Joshua, and it was a big one. When we were in 11th grade or just after, his dad died of cancer, which really kind of threw him off and was obviously quite tragic. Now, fast forward 30-some years, the very age his dad gets cancer, Jason gets cancer. All right, you with me so far?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so now, unfortunately, Jason's cancer cannot be cured, all the chemo, all the radiation, and then about 3 years ago, Jason has 15 pounds of cancer in his back. It's doubling every few weeks, and his oncologist tearfully says, Jason, I love you, man, but it's time to go home and die. And Jason goes home, gets in hospice, and at the last minute, he takes this off-label immunotherapy drug. Who knows if it'll work? It's a Hail Mary, to say the least. And a few weeks later, his girlfriend wakes him up and says, Jason, get out of bed. You won't believe this. Your tumors have disappeared.
Wow.
So, I mean, wow, by orders of a million, a thousand, I don't even know what you can say. He's risen from the grave. So this part I would say for anybody who has had cancer, who knows someone who has cancer, I just said, I got to pick up my pen. And a lot of people have written, Joshua, and then I'll sum up how this book started, about immunotherapy. I decided to dig a little bit further. I was dissatisfied with understanding only immunotherapy, which is this new way of dealing with cancer and autoimmunity. I said, what is the immune system in the first place? How have we gotten to a place where we can not only understand, but tinker at a molecular level with this thing? What is this thing? And what unfolded was this book, An Elegant Defense.
Yeah, the subtitle of the book, we should note, is The Extraordinary New Science of the Immune System. That would imply, of course, Matt, that scientists are still acknowledging that there's a lot that they don't know and that they're kind of discovering. Were there any particular misconceptions or preconceptions about the immune system that you had before writing this book?
Yeah, Joshua, let me lay myself bare. despite being married to a doctor, I had so many misconceptions. And I think it's what wound up driving me to write a book. After all, you spend many years thinking about a book before you commit. It's a major undertaking. But when I realized how many misconceptions I had, and you alluded to one at the very beginning of this book, and it goes to the story of Jason, and then in this book are three other major characters, two women with autoimmune disorders, one man with a perfect immune system studied by the NIH, and all of them went to this most basic misconception I had, which is we do not want to boost our immune system. Joshua, let me just ask you, are you with me that you sort of, we've heard over time, boost your immune system, boost your immune system, boost your immune system?
Yeah, I mean, you know, nobody has been told to kind of weaken their immune system. You want to keep it as healthy as possible and, you know, and keep it as robust as possible to keep, to fight infections.
So this is the most basic misconception I had, and it stemmed from a broader misconception about the immune system. I'll just say this. The better language is to support your immune system. Boosting your immune system may lead to more dangerous places than even the pathogens that would seek to protect us, to attack us. To explain that, it might be helpful if I sort of sought to define the immune system as we are now beginning to understand it much, much better than we had even 50 years ago.
Yeah, I was just going to ask you to do that. When we say the immune system, Matt, what exactly are we referring to?
Yeah, so, I mean, in some part, what we've understood is very essential and true, which is it is this network meant to defend us from alien presences. But where that gets overstated and sort of misconceived in points is that it suggests we've got this super zealous police force that is constantly attacking, destroying, you know, battling. And while that is true to some extent, what is truer still is that it is as much a peacekeeping force as it is a force that would seek to destroy all the alien organisms in and around us. And to understand that, I'll give you another basic misconception I have, or rather, let me explain the world that we actually live in, rather than the world that I think I brought, that I understood coming into this book.
Well, actually, before you do that, Matt, let me just remind folks that we are speaking to Matt Richtel, a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist. His new book is called An Elegant Defense, The Extraordinary New Science of the Immune System. We'd love to hear from you, especially if you have had situations in the past where you learned something about your own immune system or about the immune system that you did not know. Perhaps you're a healthcare practitioner and you're having to adjust the way that you deal with the immune systems of your patients, or maybe you just have questions about how the immune system works and what we're learning that's new. Email us 1A@WAMU.org, tweet us at 1A, or comment on our Facebook page. Matt, go ahead.
All right, at the risk of dating myself, you remember the movie The Matrix where all the ones and zeros came out?
Oh, yeah.
And the world looked like, okay. This is the first thing, the first most basic grounding that I've had to reconceptualize. We are essentially surrounded by microbes on everything, in everything, on our skin, on your desk, on the microphone. Imagine all those ones and zeros are bacteria, virus, parasite, cells, molecules. You with me so far? So you're moving through space of microbes. All right. First principle. Now, here's the problem. If you think of your immune system as a zealous defender going to war with all those things on us, on our skin, around us, in our bodies, it basically would be nuclear holocaust all the time.
Hmm.
You would destroy your environment and yourself in the process. So, the big first principle here is that the main thing the immune system is trying to do, I heard how hard I accentuated the word main. That's how much I mean it.
Mm-hmm.
Is that we are trying to essentially get along with a world of alien organisms as peaceably as possible and attacking when only necessary and with as little collateral damage as possible. That is the immune system in its essence.
I know we have to pause in just a minute, Matt, but you, in your book, you return to a metaphor that you refer to as the festival of life. Before we pause, what do you mean by that, the festival of life?
So the festival of life is this body of organisms and cells swimming inside you as if there's a giant take-all-comers party inside you. And if you think of the immune system, it is trying to be as delicate a bouncer as possible. Because if it starts disrupting the festival of life with one bar fight or brawl after the next, your body will be undone. And the truth is, so many people are suffering when the festival of life gets overcome by inflammation or too much attacking. And I'll pause there because I know we need a break and explain more when we have time.
Well, yeah, and I do want to talk more about that balance and how people create that balance as we continue with Matt Richtel, the author of the new book, An Elegant Defense. Glad to get some of your questions and comments in there, too. Peggy emailed, I drove a school bus for a number of years. My doctor said I should now have a great immune system. It still seems to be the case. And Stephen tweets, I agree with George Carlin. He said that growing up, they used to swim in the East River, and they never got sick because their immune systems were steeled in raw sewage. Is that true? Is exposure to having that kind of, you know, attack on your immune system actually strengthening it? We'll get to that, and we'll answer some more of your questions as well. I'm Joshua Johnson. Glad to be with you, and glad you made the very healthy choice to listen to 1A from WAMU and NPR. This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson. We're discussing the immune system with Matt Richtel of the New York Times. His latest book is called An Elegant Defense, The Extraordinary New Science of the Immune System. We'd love to hear from you, too. Comment on our Facebook page, tweet us at 1A, or email 1A@WAMU.org. So we're already starting to dispel some of the preconceptions we have about the immune system, including the nature of what it is and what it does. Maybe some of you remember that animated movie Osmosis Jones that came out back in 2001, where Chris Rock plays a white blood cell who's kind of a cop fighting an evil virus.
Yo, you see this badge? You see this gun? You see this gooey white saccus membranous around my personhood?
Here we go again.
Well, you dealing with a white blood cell here. I should be out in the veins fighting disease, not in the mouth on Carter control.
You're lucky you ain't in a scab. Uh-oh, looks like we got some germs on that egg.
Baby, it's Isaac time.
It's probably gingivitis. Don't get carried away.
That's Chris Rock in the 2001 animated movie Osmosis Jones. And Matt, that's kind of a silly example, but talk about how our cultural understanding of bacteria, of viruses, of disease has evolved over the last few decades, particularly as it relates to keeping our kids clean and safe from disease. I mean, that was a lot of the mainstream of the commercials that we played at the top of the show.
Yeah. So in the book, I actually note a study out of Columbia University where they looked at the marketing since about 1920 going forward. And there has been an increasingly I guess on some level you'd call it a fear-based campaign that you are surrounded by noxious things that would seek to kill you. And you need to cleanse your environment with all kinds of soaps, the cleaner, the better. And That combined with what was really so let's set that aside in one corner, and then let's also put in another corner the fact that, yes, for many years, germs were very dangerous. So undercooked meat, a poke of a stick, we faced all kinds of risks in our environment. And as a result, that marketing campaign played to some deeply primitive impulses that go back all the way to the Bible. I note a passage in Exodus that talks about ritual washing. Those forces combined to make us basically germophobes. Yeah. Does that make sense?
Yeah, Although there, okay, there are also those folks who, kind of on the flip side, like Elizabeth, who emails, I grew up outside, dirty hands, scraped knees. My parents didn't freak and bathe me in antibacterial soap. I rode horses and ate lunch with one hand with a pitchfork in the other. I never got sick. Humans try to control things for which they aren't equipped. So I'm hearing, Matt, this kind of cultural shift you're describing.
Yeah, and there's a lot to that point that she's making, and I'm going to give you the science behind it. I have a chapter in the book called "Should You Pick Your Nose," which is actually, and it's excerpted today in the New York Times. If anybody wants to glance at that piece of it, but it raises this very question. Let me tell you the science behind it. There have been two stages in sort of a reckoning with that over-hygienic culture. One was the hygiene hypothesis, which emerged over the last 20, 30 years. And it essentially said, when your environment gets too clean, you begin to develop more allergy, and you might begin to develop more of a cousin of allergy, which is autoimmune disorder. We can talk about in a little while.
Right. We'll get to
that. Why would that be? Sorry, go ahead.
I said we'll get to that, but go ahead.
We'll get to that. Why would that be? Well, the idea is that if you think of your immune system now as this delicate bouncer, or I like to think of it as a bouncer and the love child of a bouncer and a ballet dancer, it needs to get trained on how to tiptoe, where to attack. If you remove some of the pathogens and the challenges that it faces, it's harder for it to get trained. But since that time, Joshua, we have, and this is some of the newer stuff, and it's really, this is where it really gets interesting, is that we've learned that it's not merely the bad guys that train us. It's all the microbes. Let me distinguish pathogen and microbe. Pathogen is a bad guy. Microbe is all those ones and zeros around us we talk about. If we cleanse our environment, we not only rid ourselves of the tough guys or bad guys that are trying to attack us, but all those good ones that inform our immune system, too, about when to attack and where to tread lightly. And that is called, by some people, the old friends mechanism. Mm-hmm. So we've lost some of the pathogens and some of the old friends, all of which inform our immune system.
So it's kind of like your immune system never gets trained to do its job because it's never in an environment that resembles the critical part of its job.
And if you go back to your Chris Rock reference, here's a guy that's poised to pull out his weapon. And the other piece of, to just to add to what you just said, which is you nailed it, is that it's also a system that is poised to attack sometimes. It's kind of energetic. In some ways, I think of the immature immune system, if you want another metaphor, as a little puppy dog looking to play around. If you don't give it stuff to play around with, it has all this energy, and it's not sure then later on when to bite and when to nibble.
And it'll tear up the couch if you let it. You mentioned a doctor. You mentioned a doctor that you interviewed in the book, who said, and I'm quoting from the book now, when people tell you your immune system is weak, they are wrong. Anyone who wants to boost your immune system doesn't know what they're saying. Unquote. Now this is the same doctor who says that if you drop food on the floor, you should eat it. So are we throwing out the 5-second rule? Are we affirming, like, why should we eat food that's fallen on the floor?
Well, it's not why should we eat food that's fallen on the floor, although for anyone who's hungry, different conversation. But the question is, why shouldn't we eat food that's fallen on the floor? And what the reason we shouldn't, or what we've told ourselves, is anything that's got any quote-unquote germs on it is going to do X, Y, or Z to our bodies. And the reality is it's very unlikely to do X, Y, or Z. And the reason is that most of those microbes that surround us are not really pathogens. They're not parasites, bacteria, or virus that want to destroy us. They're part of this larger universe of microbes that we're trying to get along with, cooperate with, and this is now even one step further that I'm going to give you, rely upon to help us survive in the world. And when I say rely upon, it's going to force us to turn to the microbiome, our gut, and and part of the body we thought had nothing to do with health that has very much to do with it. It is populated by friendly or commensal bacteria that assist in our health. Let me just make one big caveat about raw meat here, lest anyone start picking their food off the floor. This book, while it has caused me to be less germophobic in many respects, I am really careful with how I handle raw meat. Our kitchen is a little bit like infection control. It's a little bit of a separate conversation, but please do wash your utensils, wash your counter. When you get that raw meat, it can spread some of those pathogenic bacteria around your kitchen.
We got a number of comments from people who've dealt with a variety of autoimmune disorders, and I want to get to those in just a moment. But one last piece of this before we start talking about autoimmune disorders. There's this concern about antibiotics and the risk of so-called superbugs, these bacteria that have evolved to basically survive or get around modern antibiotics. At one point, you quote a report from a few years ago that predicts that by the year 2050, more people will die from resistant bacteria than from cancer. Why is that? Is that because we're creating this environment, or are there other factors?
This is a related topic, and coincidentally, in the next few weeks, the New York Times is going to launch a series on this very topic that I spent all of last year reporting. And what is going on here is that these pathogens, these bacteria, in particular when we're talking about antibiotics, are doing exactly what any organism would do if it was being destroyed. They are finding ways to survive. They're doing it in ways we never imagined, not just evolving, but transferring defenses one to the next so that a bacteria we once killed with antibiotic now can be impervious to that antibiotic. We douse and pour antibiotics on everything. Sometimes, Joshua, it is so necessary. But the CDC will tell you that about 30% of the antibiotics we take in the U.S. alone are unnecessary. We take them because we're afraid we have a disease our immune system can't fight off when it actually can. And then those bacteria begin to evolve and they become develop defenses. And the next time they come around, we can't do nothing.
Let me get to some of your comments, particularly those of you who have been dealing with various autoimmune disorders. These are illnesses that are caused when your immune system attacks your body. Kathleen from Florida emailed, "For over a decade, I have battled with, you name it, immune system problems, including blisters on my entire body, horrendous eczema, horrible digestive issues, and more. The constant answers from many specialists were the usual. Put this steroid cream on, or literally, they told me not to come back to see them because they had no idea what to do with me." Ruth tweeted, "I have had lupus since I was a child. Doctors have told me to stay away from anything that boosts the immune system. Other people tell me to eat sauerkraut or just do insert wacky theory here." And we also heard from some of you who did talk about the nature of antibiotics, including this listener who left a note in our inbox.
"My name is Laura. I'm from North Carolina. I have ulcerative colitis, which is an autoimmune disease that attacks your gut. I think overuse of antibiotics is at least one of the major reasons I developed this condition, and I try to avoid them whenever possible. The hardest thing about having it is just the invisibility of it, having to kind of explain to people sensitive topics related to the disease, and sort of at a certain point accepting that people can only have so much empathy when they're not the one living with it."
Yeah, Laura, thanks very much for sharing your story with us. I'm Joshua Johnson, and you're listening to 1A. Matt, the rate of autoimmune disorders in this country is rising, as I understand it. 1 in 5 Americans suffers from some kind of autoimmune condition. Is that right?
Yes, and I just love that call. May I respond to that?
Of course.
All three of those.
Sure.
The last caller used the word invisible. It's such a beautiful word in this context. one little high-level thing. In this book, I talk to two women, and I outline and chronicle their autoimmune disorders as a way of explaining the science behind autoimmune disorders. It is fascinating. So I hope it's valuable to some of those listeners calling in. I want to key on the word invisible, and I want to key on something else. All three callers were women. That is no coincidence. I refer historically to the sufferers of autoimmune disorders as the invisible women, and I do it for two reasons. One, these diseases are invisible in their own way. So unlike most diseases, where the doctors, the scientists found a pathogen, a bacteria, a virus, a parasite, there is no thing to see other than you attacking yourself. So in some ways, the disease itself is invisible. The reason I add women to that conversation is women by far suffer more of these than other people. And the reasons why are fascinating, but also not fully understood. One reason appears to be that women, and this is all in the book, women confer immunity to their children. They may have stronger immune systems as a result of that. They are caregivers. They also appear to have more immune functions associated with their with the X chromosome than the Y chromosome. And one positive of this is women live longer, but they also have stronger immune systems. And as we've outlined in this conversation before, stronger doesn't always mean better. What is happening inside these women? Let me pause because I've been long-winded in that. I'm passionate about this. So far so good, Joshua, on this?
Yeah, no, that's fine. Actually, we have a number of other listeners who are sharing their stories about autoimmune conditions and also just about whether or not we should or how to adjust our antibacterial lifestyles. Beth emailed, I've had Crohn's disease since 2008, and after many different medications and a 10-day stint in the hospital, I was prescribed Humira. I went into remission, but it suppressed my immune system and made me more prone to getting bugs and infections. Then, in September, I was diagnosed with breast cancer. It's tough to juggle your illnesses and medication side effects, but I'd suggest to anyone in a similar situation to find a good doctor and adopt a healthy lifestyle. Crohn's disease, by the way, is an inflammatory bowel disease. It can cause inflammation of your digestive tract. Matt, what would you say to Beth, particularly the difficulty of trying to manage a variety of different diseases involving the immune system?
Well, again, I love her call because it is, and I feel for you, Beth, it is so characteristic of these stories. She said something really potent. She used one of these drugs that dulls the immune system. In some ways, it is a radical benefit to people who might have their immune system attacking them. But what it does is exactly what she says. When you dull this delicate bouncer meets ballet dancer, you put yourself at risk of getting sick. One of the phrases I use in the book over and over again is tinker with your immune system at your own risk. And what she said here is adopt a healthy lifestyle is really a powerful statement, because what it means is you want to live in the best way possible to support this mechanism that's working so effectively beneath the surface of our consciousness all the time. Thank you, Beth. Really helpful call.
Want to get to some more of your questions and comments in just a moment, including those of you who've asked some questions about antibacterial soap. Carly from Orlando emailed, I'd like to cut down on my use of hand sanitizer and antibacterial wipes. I know I need to be less lazy and go to the bathroom to wash my and my daughter's hands at restaurants and public places, but when soap and water isn't available, what's a good alternative? And Cindy emailed, unfortunately, I spend a lot of my time in the offices of many doctors. I am always annoyed and puzzled as to why all their bathrooms have antibacterial soap instead of regular soap. While people have been brainwashed by commercials to be terrified of even one germ, you'd think doctors would know better by now. We want to get to some more of those basic questions about what to do to be a better protector of the system that protects you when we continue with Matt Richtel of the New York Times, the author of the new book, An Elegant Defense. We'll get to more of your questions and stories as well. Stay close. Back now to our conversation with Matt Richtel of the New York Times and the author of the new book, An Elegant Defense. Still time to get in some more of your questions and stories, 1A@WAMU.org. And to reiterate, we are not doctors, so please don't take any of today's conversation as a substitute for proper medical advice. Please consult your doctor to decide what's right for you. Let me get to a few more of your comments before we dive back in with Matt. JWM tweeted, I have lupus and 7 other autoimmune conditions. I'm allergic to most antibiotics and all narcotics. Instead, I use foods as medicine to balance my immune system and reduce pain. Wajobu tweets, yes, I agree that the antibacterial culture is absolute overkill, but I do know, or knew, a guy who got a deep cut in a local stream and did not clean it. It got infected, the infection attacked his pancreas, and he died. Some precautions do have to be taken. And Michaela tweets, when you live on a livestock farm, you learn to live in harmony with all kinds of bacteria. You also learn a lot about resistance when treating animals. They, too, have the same issues humans do. We are constantly switching back and forth on livestock medications and preventions. Thank you all for sharing your stories with us. Please do keep them coming, 1A@WAMU.org. Before we get to some more consumer-level questions about things like antibacterial soap, I wanted to ask you about what you describe in the book as the 9/11 of immunology, which is the advent of HIV, the virus that causes AIDS. How did the fight against HIV change or perhaps revolutionize our understanding of the immune system?
Yeah, I mean, it's very fair to say 9/11 of HIV and maybe the 9/11 of disease in our lifetimes. Along comes this thing, and no one knew what it was. And what was happening around the country is mostly men, mostly young gay men, were dying of diseases, of parasites and viruses that we ordinarily fought off. And what quickly became apparent is that it was the immune system itself that was under attack. This happened at the very moment that basically 50 years of immunology had crystallized, giving us a whole bunch of tools to begin to understand the immune system. And the combination of these things, a terrible disease attacking our immune system and a whole bunch of learning, made this like a moment of incredible discovery that has led to all the cancer treatments we have, the autoimmune treatments, but it took a crisis. It took a 9/11 of disease to get us here.
We should also note, Matt, that when people initially began dying of what we now call AIDS, they were dying of other things. Other things were listed as the official cause of death, like Kaposi's sarcoma, which is, you know, a cancer that is very, very, very rarely found in humans. And even initially, AIDS didn't have that name. That name didn't exist until, I think, 1983. Originally, it was called GRID, the gay-related immune disease. So it wasn't just a scientific fight. It was a social and a cultural fight that made immunology a public health matter and a social matter and a societal matter, too.
Yes. And so I mentioned Jason, who rose from the grave, the cancer patient, Linda and Meredith with autoimmune disorders. But as remarkable as anyone is the fourth character in this book. His name is Bob Hoff. And he got HIV the night of Halloween, 1977. And he never got AIDS. In fact, he's hardly had a symptom. He is so remarkable in his immune system that the NIH studies it, and it studies it along with a handful of other people called elite controllers to understand what is it that makes the immune system so incredible in these people that they are able to survive and thrive. I will give you, without going into the weeds, a punchline that goes to the very point you made about cultural and political diversity. One of the key things we discover from people like Bob Hoff is we need diversity in our society, both culturally and physiologically. If it were not for immune systems like Bob Hoff's, we would not have – sorry, big step back for a second, Joshua. We have a whole bunch of – all our immune systems are different as fingerprints. That is essential. Because if all our immune systems were the same and a flu pandemic came along and killed everybody and was capable of killing, it would kill everybody. We need a lot of diversity, and that's how we have survived plagues. Go ahead.
Well, I wanted to get your sense before we have to move on, because there are some other questions I'd like to get to. I'd love to get your sense with regards to the fight against HIV of this latest treatment of the so-called London patient, this person who was given a treatment for a cancer that also, it seems, has eradicated the HIV virus or made it undetectable for the last year and a half without taking any other HIV medications. I wonder what your thoughts are on that.
Yeah, I mean, I would use the term cure loosely here. And the reason is that what was required to do that was a certain kind of immune system transplant that in many ways was extremely lucky and extremely rare and extremely particular in how well it worked. Here's the challenge with an immune system transplant is, as we have discussed today, when you introduce into your body new things, in this case, a new immune system, it can actually cause your existing immune system or your body to get very dysregulated. It is not clear that we can reproduce the results of what happened to the London patient without extraordinary collateral damage. That is why, while he was cured, if you will, it doesn't look like a widespread solution to what is a problem we can now solve or hold in check with HIV cocktails.
Let's get to some listener questions now. Let's camp out with some listener questions and comments for a while. I just want to acknowledge a lot of you have been writing in who are dealing with various autoimmune disorders. Thank you so much for sharing your stories. There's no way that I can fully relate to what you're going through, but we're so grateful that you're articulating it for us as best you can. It means a lot. And I also want to acknowledge that a lot of you have said you don't know what to do about the autoimmune disorders that you're dealing with. Like Marie, who tweeted, "Sepsis survivor of 2 years here. My immune system, along with my health and energy, has not been the same since. No one can say exactly why." Thoughts, Matt?
Yeah, I do have thoughts, and this is a thought for those of you who do not have autoimmune diseases. I think we need a cultural shift here in terms of understanding that just because it appears invisible in that there's no parasite doesn't make it any less real. So again, disproportionately women, but men too, for the fatigue, for the stomach problems, for the low-grade fevers, for the rashes, to those of the rest of you, those are real. And in the past, we have dismissed those things as hysteria in your head. They are not. So that's the part I want to say to the rest of you. May I speak to those who are dealing with autoimmune diseases? Mm. For those of you who are, I do really feel for you, particularly for the historical way we've dealt with this invisible problem. I do think many, many practitioners are beginning to acknowledge two things. We need to be very creative in how we deal with this. And the other part is not so comforting, but it is in a distant way. We understand that we don't understand all of what's causing this, and we need to work harder. A lot of practitioners are beginning to say, "I believe you. Believe me, I believe you." We have to look creatively. Is there a lifestyle change? Is there a medicine we can try? Is there an off-label medicine we can try? Don't give up. The two women in this book each have found very different solutions to the problem, and hopefully they will enlighten and enable some of you to help find solutions yourselves.
Let's back up to that question from Carly in Orlando. Carly emailed, "I'd like to cut down on my use of hand sanitizer and antibacterial wipes. I know I need to be less lazy and go to the bathroom to wash my and my daughter's hands at restaurants and public places, but when soap and water isn't available, what is a good alternative?" Give us your sense of using hand sanitizers versus plain old soap and water for Carly.
Yeah, first of all, soap and water, the doctors will always talk about. And I want to get to the thing someone said about doctor's offices. But Carly, soap and water, when you can, when you can't, I would look up which of those do not have extensive antibacterial properties such that they will do less damage. There are natural products out there, and I'm not going to endorse or play the medical role in that, but I think you can go look up the better alternatives. May I speak to, I think it was Carly or someone else who asked about doctor's offices.
Another listener asked about doctor's offices, yeah, but go ahead.
Let me just speak to that really quickly. Two answers to this. On one level, I think doctors are awakening to this as well. I mentioned my wife is a doctor, and some of the stuff I've learned about antibiotics and resistance that I've done for the New York Times coming up shortly was news to her as well. She went to medical school only, you know, 15 years ago or so, and they just did not talk about resistance very much. But there's another reason, and it is very good, why they are thinking about infection in doctor's offices. This is a place where a lot of infection exists. And it's also a place where there are a lot of people who have weakened immune systems and maybe therefore more receptive to infection. So I don't want to suggest here that we want to live in an unclean environment.
Right.
It's rather that industrial processes that we use, and I can name a bunch of them, often cause us to go overboard and deal with collateral effects. We as humans often bring hammers to very delicate natural problems. And as we grow wiser, as we grow more informed, we learn to bring tinier hammers to those problems so that we don't do other damage.
So briefly to Carly's question, if there's no good alternative, should we just rinse our hands off with water and pat them down and go back to the table and wash our hands when we get home? Like, what's the best alternative if so?
I would say that would work. I mean, you have to know, again, you have to know your environment. Mm-hmm. If you're in a place where there is raw meat or animal feces or some other decidedly unclean thing, that is one set of circumstances. But most of what is around us is
right.
Not that bad for us. Let me put it another way.
Briefly.
Here, Joshua, it's okay to get a head cold now and again. In fact, it may serve you just fine. You don't need to insulate yourself from all germs and disease.
I'm Joshua Johnson. You're listening to 1A. Catherine emailed, please ask your guest about the value of taking probiotics to support the immune system.
Yes. So we haven't gotten to the microbiome yet, but the microbiome are all these cells in your gut, and they play an incredible role in your health. And increasingly, we have learned that they even transmit signals to your immune system across the lining of the gut to help it thrive. Here's the question about probiotics. There is a lot of belief that having a healthy, diverse gut is helpful. The challenge right now, if you ask the lead immunologists, is a ton of claims are being made about how to do that, and it's not necessarily all that clear which probiotics under which circumstances work.
Gotcha.
This is, again, where I would urge people to look a little deeper to understand the basic science. So it will inform your questions. Joshua, as you said, I don't want to be a medical professional here, and I want to give people the basic science and then let them do their own research.
A few more quick questions before we got to go. Matt tweets, diet, diet, diet. How can people expect a tiny pill to do magic but continue to put 2,000 to 3,000 calories of sugar and junk into their bodies and not expect it to affect their health? Matt, how much does diet factor in?
Matt, boom. Thank you for bringing that up. It does factor it for a couple of reasons. If you eat a lot of stuff, first of all, indirectly, it's really big because foods that are obesogenic, processed foods, can add fat to your body, which has the impact of creating inflammatory signals. So you've got to eat healthier food and more natural food. When you enter processed food into your body, you're putting things in there that force the immune system to react in some way, or can. I can't say enough about diet, but I do want to say this. Diet works indirectly on the immune system. We just know enough to know natural foods that aren't obesogenic are much better for you.
One more thing I wanted to ask, and this comes from the end of the book. You write, quote, "We must continue to strive, dream, and exercise all the passions that have gotten us this far, while also doing a much better job of accepting death. Death is not just inevitable, not just programmed into us and facilitated in ways by our immune system. It is essential for our survival," unquote. Before I let you go, what did the immune system teach you about death and about the way we live our lives?
Yeah, if I really talk about what this book is about at the end of the day, it's about the cycle of life. And the immune system teaches us, the immune system we tend to think about as defending us as individuals. What I have learned at the end of the day, the bottom line and every other cliche, is that the immune system is here to defend the species. And it is working in such a way as to keep us alive long enough to promote and sustain the species. And that is what it's trying to do. And therefore, we are at once trying to propel our lives, live longer, live better, but we must also accept what the immune system is at its heart. And that is a defender of the species.
And so when we reach death, does that broaden your view of death in a more of a species-wide way before we go?
Well, I mean, to be a little bit emotional about it, which is what I've tried to do in the book, you know, how can I hold life and love all my children and my wife and life itself and accept death? That's the challenge that I've walked away from this book with. When I die, when it comes time, or a loved one, I will at least carry some intellectual understanding that is part of the process. Whether it will still hurt is almost certain.
Matt Richtel is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and the author of the new book, An Elegant Defense, The Extraordinary New Science of the Immune System. Matt, thanks for talking to us.
Thanks, Joshua.
Today's conversation was produced by Paige Osborne. To learn more about her and the rest of our team, visit the1a.org/staff. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. Until we meet again, I'm Joshua Johnson. Thanks for listening. This is 1A.